This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Congress took a modest step this week toward tightening the nation's gun control laws. As families of the Sandy Hook shooting victims looked on, the Senate voted to allow a compromise gun control bill to come to a vote.
If passed, the bill would require background checks for gun sales at many gun shows. Here's what it would not do. Require background checks on gun sales from private sellers. It would also not ban assault weapons or high-capacity ammunition clips like those used in the massacre of 20 children and school staff in Newtown, Connecticut.
Still, it represents the first effort to strengthen federal gun control laws in 20 years. We're joined now by John Rosenthal. He's a Boston real estate developer and founder of Stop Handgun Violence. And good to have you, John.
Thank you.
You've been advocating for stronger gun laws for a long, long time. You've been discouraged for a long, long time that anything meaningful could happen. If passed, would this compromise bill in the Senate make a difference in your view?
Well, it'll close two important deadly loopholes so that private gun sellers at gun shows and on the internet will now have to comply with running a background check just like federally licensed gun dealers, but it will do nothing to prevent private gun dealers and anyone outside of a gun show or on the internet to sell guns to criminals. So,
and how significant is that, John? I mean, how big a part of the problem is that, in your view?
It is huge. Private gun sellers sell about 6 million guns a year without being required to run a background check. Mm. Now, a bunch of them happen at gun shows. There's 4,000 gun shows, and a lot of them happen on the internet. But just as many happen outside of those venues, and Congress seems to think that's okay for private gun sellers to continue to sell to criminals and the mentally ill without detection.
Well, given the political climate around this issue in Washington and across the country, is this a case of something being better than nothing? In other words, are you encouraged at all by the movement here?
I'm a little encouraged, and something is always better than nothing. But I'm also very suspect. I imagine that a background check for criminals is a hard vote for members of Congress, even for the Democrats. And then you will see next week, although Senator Warren and Cowen and many other Democratic senators will add amendments, including the prohibition on the size of ammunition magazines, which is critical. I mean, there are 11 little kids from Newtown who are alive today because they escaped a classroom when Adam Lanza had to reload his 30-round clip on a Bushmaster assault weapon. Police officers are killed when they are reloading because they have 13 rounds, but Congress thinks it's fine for the criminals and the mentally ill to have 30 to 100 round magazines. So we're going to add that back in next week, and then there'll be an amendment to add back in the military-style weapon, the assault weapon ban. But so will other amendments, like an amendment that Lindsey Graham will add that will say that people who are involuntarily committed to mental institutions should now be able to buy guns. And they're going to lift, a ban on gun ownership by the mentally ill veterans. And they're also going to add an amendment to declare that all restrictions on firearms, like we have proven to work in Massachusetts. I mean, remember, Massachusetts is an urban industrial state. We have the lowest firearm fatality rate in the nation. What Congress is going to add next week is that all weapons restrictions would be a violation of the Second Amendment, and therefore our Massachusetts laws would therefore be revoked. So
all
we
right.
have a big uphill battle.
So more to come, and of course more coverage to come on this issue. John Rosenthal, founder of Stop Handgun Violence, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Gun Valley. It sounds like the title of an old Western, but in fact, it's what some people call the part of Western Massachusetts and Connecticut where the modern gun industry is thriving. It's home to companies like Smith & Wesson, Colt, and Savage Arms. Reporter Neil Swidey writes about it in this weekend's Boston Globe magazine.
Swidey tells the story of a series of thriving gun companies, of how many people in Blue State, Massachusetts, view guns and the gun industry, and how guns built and still maintain a robust manufacturing sector in the state.
Gun Valley is the area of Western Massachusetts down through Connecticut that hugs the Connecticut River Valley, and it's where industrial gun making began. It began at the Springfield Armory that spawned a lot of suppliers and small manufacturers in that area, and it's to this day where a lot of big gun manufacturers are headquartered.
There is sort of an irony here, isn't there? Blue State, Massachusetts, with some of the toughest gun control laws in the nation, with this thriving homegrown gun industry alive and well.
That's absolutely true. And when you add it with Connecticut, also some of the toughest gun laws in the nation, the scene of the horrible, unspeakable tragedy in Newtown, and yet the historic hub of a lot of the big gun manufacturing, and where a lot of those high-paying gun jobs, both on the line and the executive salaries, still reside.
And Neil, why is the gun industry doing so well? You know, in the wake of the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, gun owners are worried that they're not going to have an opportunity in the near future to buy guns, so there's a sort of run on guns. Does that explain it, or is there something more complicated that explains this boom in the gun industry?
Well, that's kind of the question I was looking for an answer for. The gun industry is booming, I think, on one level. The most obvious one, as you point out, is the political issue. The fear among gun owners stoked by the NRA and other people that they're somehow the guns are going to be taken away. But that's only one piece of it. And what else is happening there is, I think, is a more interesting question. And that has to do with manufacturing and design and lower prices for relatively high-quality products. And shrewdly tapping into that have been companies like Savage that have brought down price points, have offered more selection, and have given reason to existing gun owners to buy more guns.
You also write about public policy from states like Massachusetts and Connecticut that have help the gun industry. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how people like Governor Deval Patrick and others have promoted the local gun industry as a source of economic development.
This is an interesting dimension to this whole issue, because if you look, some very prominent gun control favoring politicians have worked to advance measures that help the gun industry because they're employers and because they're giving good-paying blue-collar jobs to people who might not otherwise have a whole lot of options. So in late 2010, Governor Deval Patrick pushed through $6 million in tax breaks for Smith & Wesson out in Springfield. The goal was to move about 200 jobs or so from New Hampshire to Springfield and to do more expansion there. That happened. Now Governor Patrick is, of course, pushing gun control measures in favor of an assault rifle ban, which, incidentally, Smith & Wesson does make assault rifles. And that gets at the interesting dimension of the politics of it and the kind of bread and butter of good jobs.
Yeah, good jobs. I mean, these are pretty well-paying jobs. I mean, we think about manufacturing in Massachusetts has sort of gone with the textile industry and so forth. But as you write, this is a manufacturing industry that is still there and produces jobs that pay relatively well.
It does. And that's another sort of revelation for me. I mean, I grew up outside of Fall River, a textile capital of the world at one point. And manufacturing, we were taught in Lowell and other places, was firmly in New England's past. But what you do see now is guns being a leading edge indicator for reshoring, jobs coming back to the United States and back to a high-cost, unionized New England because you have this specialized labor, which, when you go back in history, was what propelled the growth of Western Mass and that whole Gun Valley area, was high-skilled labor.
Yeah, and you have this great line in your piece, guns built the middle class in Western Massachusetts.
And that's absolutely true. What was fascinating about the armory for two centuries had one customer, the U.S. Army.
This is the Springfield Armory, right?
The Springfield Armory. It started out making muskets for the military and continued right up until the 60s. It started to wind down in the Kennedy administration when they moved for privatizing and ended firmly in 1968. But during those two centuries, it not only created a lot of guns and a lot of jobs around that, but it created this whole loose network of small manufacturers and suppliers based on high-skilled labor. They shared labor, they shared technology and innovation, and they became a kind of technological hub for other industries. That's why aerospace went out there. That's why automotive went out there, because of that labor. And now, as people point out, I think very smart people, if the region is smart, they'll try to use this gun boom to create jobs outside of the gun industry, advanced manufacturing jobs, based on that high-skilled labor that's there.
Mm. And speaking of that, tell me a little bit about VSS, which is a small manufacturing company in Greenfield that you wrote about. It's busier than ever, thanks to the gun industry, and you write that it can't find enough skilled workers right now, which is surprising because we think about people needing jobs and here are jobs waiting to be had, but he literally can't find enough people to fill the jobs that he has available.
VSS, again, is a fascinating story. They were a company that was sort of on their way out, sort of firmly in the past, and a while back, the young executive who took it over, a family company, put a bet on the future, invested a lot in. And they need two things. You need to have some capacity and understanding of IT, and you need to have mechanical ability. And those two things are very hard to find now. The old workers didn't necessarily adapt so well to the IT needs. And the young kids coming up now, liberal arts grads or other things, used to mess around with under the hood of their car in the driveway, and they would sort of forge some kind of mechanical ability. They don't have that now. You can't really mess around with your car because of all the computerized needs of it. And so when they're coming out, you have college grads coming out with lots of debt and not great job prospects. And here you have these jobs that pay 50, 100 grand even to run some of these machines, and they can't find anyone to fill them. It's a crazy situation right now, and it's one that I think is a real opportunity for us.
Another thing that really struck me about the piece that you wrote was the attitudes about guns by the people who work in this industry. And you talk to a lot of people who work in the industry who actually don't own guns, who actually don't shoot guns, who aren't sort of passionate about Second Amendment rights, and yet there they are working in the industry.
This was another revelation. You know, so I was able to go on the Savage factory floor and actually build a gun. They usually allow only people, members of their tribe, writers for guns and ammo or hunting show hosts and celebrities like that to do this. But my case with them was to sort of create some understanding of the nuance in this issue. And I wanted to find the people who actually make the guns and get their opinions. And I didn't know exactly what to expect, how hardcore people's opinions would be. And when you get tragedies like Newtown, it just makes the opinions firmer on both sides. But here was nuance. Here was complexion. A quarter of the workers at Savage, according to the company, maybe slightly more, are gun owners and shooters. The others are not. For the vast majority of the workers I met, these were good jobs at a good, stable company. And that was it.
And Neil, that seems to sort of parallel what you observe about the national debate around guns. And that is the majority of gun owners, you suggest, have sort of ceded the debate to a small minority of extreme voices in the debate. That is, most gun owners have relatively moderate views on gun control.
That's absolutely right. When you have three quarters of NRA members in favor of universal background checks, the difference between that and the head of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, sort of in the strident, never cede an inch stance that he takes on behalf of gun owners, but at quite a distance from where gun owners seem to be, that's pretty remarkable. Another poll showed close to 90% of households where there's an NRA member in the household, their support for universal background check. What that tells us, I think, is that there is more room for common ground than we might think. If we can somehow wrest this debate from the voices on the edges, especially on the NRA side, and get some solutions tapping into that area where there is common ground.
Well, that's Neil Swidey. His piece, Greetings from Gun Valley, will be in this weekend's Boston Globe magazine. Neil Swidey, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
And you can find a link to Neil Swidey's piece at RadioBoston.org, where you can also post your comments about guns, gun control, and the Massachusetts gun industry. Let us know what you think.
In a moment, two musical masters and the making of a violin concerto. That's up next. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.